Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Iraq's interim president says the United States will hand Saddam Hussein over to Iraqi authorities within the next 2 weeks. President Ghazi al-Yawar also told reporters the deposed dictator will be tried as soon as possible. But Saddam Hussein may be the proverbial hot potato. Judges in Iraq who fear for their lives are refusing to sit on his tribunal, while the Red Cross is concerned about how long he can be held without being officially charged. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Washington Post correspondent Ed Cody. Ed, welcome.
Thank you.
Does the United States want to hand Saddam over?
I think President Bush has said from the very beginning that he wants Saddam Hussein to be tried by an Iraqi tribunal. The question is, when can that happen? That's what's under discussion right now.
Well, not just when, but how credible a trial it would be, right?
Well, I suppose that's a factor, but the main situation is, right now anyway, is that the Iraqi interim government that's been in place for a couple of weeks now is very eager to accumulate the various symbols of its sovereignty, and one of them, among others, would be to have custody of the prisoners, including Saddam Hussein. But the security situation here in Iraq is just such that that doesn't sound very practical at all, even though the Prime Minister, Ayad Alawi, said last night that he thought that the turnover ought to occur within 2 weeks when Iraq assumes at least formal sovereignty. There's very little expectation by anybody, particularly American officials, that that will actually happen in such a short time.
Well, does he pose a security threat for the interim government?
Yes, just by his very existence, he does. In other words, someone would have to be in charge of him. He would have to be put in a place. The place would have to be guarded. It would have to be secure. The people around him would have to be secure. You've got to get this special tribunal together, which is not together. A number of judges have been assassinated. No one is eager to be part of the tribunal the way the security situation is. And those things, it's just not a practical idea right now.
Well, but here you are with the Red Cross saying that international laws stipulate that Hussein must be released when the Americans hand over power to Iraq unless someone is able to come up with some charges pretty immediately.
Well, my understanding is that that has been explained in a different way now by the Red Cross itself. And the Americans, of course, contend that under international law, as long as hostilities are underway, as they certainly are here in Iraq, the obligation to release a prisoner of war does not kick in.
You know, it's so interesting because here's Saddam, the legend, the villain, the tyrant, sitting somewhere in custody, and yet there is so little that we know about him. What do we know? Is he being interrogated? Is he being compliant? Any idea how he might be holding up?
Well, we know even less than you suggest. We don't know that he's in Baghdad. The most credible reports are that he's off somewhere out of the country, maybe on a ship, maybe in some facility in Qatar, a neighboring Persian Gulf country. But no one really knows that. The United States has simply not said. There have been little reports filtering out that he is not cooperating, that he's not a cooperative witness. And no one knows exactly the conditions of his confinement. It just hasn't been talked about.
Ed, thank you.
You're more than welcome.
Ed Cody is a correspondent for The Washington Post. He joined us from Baghdad.
Brigadier General Janice Karpinski is continuing to defend her oversight of soldiers in Iraq. Karpinski has been waging a one-woman campaign, claiming she's been made a scapegoat for abuse at Abu Ghraib prison, abuse that was perpetrated while she was in charge of the 16 prisons in Iraq. In a report aired today, Karpinski told the BBC that Major General Jeffrey Miller, the officer who ran the Guantanamo Bay prison and was then charged with firming up Abu Ghraib, once told her that detainees should be treated like dogs.
He said they are like dogs, and if you allow them to believe at any point that they're more than a dog, then you've lost control of them.
Well, joining us on the line is BBC correspondent Bill Law. Bill, we should say that General Miller has denied ever saying that to General Karpinski. But what else is she saying? Why wouldn't she know about abuse at a prison she was charged with overseeing?
Well, she told us that basically she was taken out of the loop. When military intelligence moved in, she was shunted aside. She wasn't kept informed. She was discouraged from being at the prison. She said that she was responsible for all the prisons in Iraq. It was difficult to get around. She witnessed only one interrogation, which she said was handled perfectly well. She put forward the thought that perhaps that was a bit of a setup. She was shown one a textbook interrogation. The other ones, the ones she says she didn't know about, the nasty ones, she's saying, hey, that's not my problem.
Why does she say the military would scapegoat her?
Well, it's interesting. She says that she's a convenient scapegoat. She says, on the one hand, she is a reservist. And there was a tendency to look down their noses a bit, the regular officers. They saw her as someone perhaps easily targeted for scapegoating. She also says that, hey, I was the first woman to lead U.S. forces into combat in Iraq. I'm a woman. Put those two together, reservist woman. Karpinski's here. We're going to hang this on Karpinski.
In the past, she said, I guess they made the mistake of thinking that I was this pitiful, dumb blonde that wouldn't take them on. But it does seem like a pretty lonely campaign. She's waging it with her cell phone. She has a lawyer. Many career military men have been critical, saying a good leader always takes the fall for what soldiers do on their watch. Has she responded to that kind of criticism?
Well, she has in part. I mean, she's defended her soldiers. She says, look, these are good soldiers. I believe that they were used by military intelligence. These young soldiers wouldn't have carried this out on their own. They were given some kind of guidance, some kind of leadership. Her take on it is that the photographs of the bodies piled up one on top of the other, various staged photographs, she says, were intended to be used to frighten new incoming prisoners, and that her soldiers maybe slipped out a digicam and took a quick flick of what was going on to say, hey, you're not going to believe this, when they got back home to West Virginia. It's a bit of a thin defense. On the other hand, she speaks very passionately and very eloquently about her feeling that she has been set up.
Can you clear up for us? There are various reports. Has she said to you, has she been suspended? Is she still in charge of the 800th MP Brigade?
She said, look, I've been suspended. That's all I've heard from the Army. As far as I'm concerned, I'm still very much in the Army. I haven't had a chance to speak to my soldiers. I'm just in a kind of limbo. They're not talking to me, but I am certainly talking to the media, and I'm taking my fight outside. I'm not going to be silent on this. I'm not going to be the scapegoat.
Bill Law, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
Bill Law, correspondent for the BBC.
Afghan President Hamid Karzai is still in Washington making the case for Western help back home. Addressing a joint session of Congress today, Karzai said that Afghanistan has emerged from a very dark era but needs more support from the West to stabilize and rebuild his country. In a later appearance with President Bush, Karzai thanked America for its help and said life is getting better in Afghanistan.
Our economy in the year 2002 grew by 30%. In the year 2003, by 25% or more. In the year 2004, the growth is estimated to be 20%. Thank you very much. This could have not been possible without America's assistance. We are sending today 5 million children to school. Almost half of those children are girls. We are building a national army, a vital institution for the defense of our country. You want us to stand on our own feet. You want us to defend our own sovereignty and provide security to our people, and you're helping us do that.
For another view of how Afghanistan is doing these days, we turn to Hamida Ghaffour, who reports for the Los Angeles Times. She's based in Kabul. Welcome, Hamida.
Thank you.
Karzai has been the target of at least one assassination attempt. There was also, we're told, a demonstration today in Kabul demanding his resignation. Is Karzai seen as an American puppet, or does he seem to have a pretty solid hold on power?
Karzai doesn't have much power in Afghanistan, unfortunately. In the south and the east, the Americans are fighting a war against the Taliban and what remains of al-Qaeda. In the north, the warlords control the countryside and much of the northern provinces. They're the same as in the west. But he does have power in Kabul. He's trying his best to extend that influence by appointing governors of his choice. But at the moment, it doesn't seem like it's working.
Well, what can he do to overcome the warlords?
Karzai needs the support of the west. That is the biggest problem he has. Most ordinary Afghans will tell you that they support the president because he is a moderate and he does appear to have the best interests of the country at heart. But the Americans, unfortunately, are allied with some of the warlords who are undermining Karzai. A lot of these warlords are also involved in the drugs trade and drug trafficking. They're allies on the war against terror, but they're not necessarily allies of President Karzai.
Well, as you say, the problems of the warlord seems to be inextricably tied to the problem of illegal poppies being grown for opium. How's he doing on that front?
Again, he's not doing very well on that front, but it is not entirely President Karzai's fault. The British government the British are the lead nation on eradication of poppy crops. They've tried two or three strategies and they've failed.
Well, all of that would certainly seem to be complicating plans for elections that are scheduled for September. Are the Afghan people ready for elections?
At the moment, it does not seem like elections in September are likely. Registration is a little bit slow at the moment. There have only been 3.5 million people registered, and the UN is targeting 10 million voters. A lot of the south and the eastern parts of the country are off-limits to AIDS workers, and UN's elections people are very afraid to venture beyond the major cities. The other problem is, and this is just as important, is it's going to cost $100 million to hold the elections. $70 million has been pledged by the international community, but actually not a penny is in the bank. The UN spokesman has said that recently.
Well, as the Bush administration looks to Afghanistan as a success story, do you see much reason for optimism?
I personally don't see much reason for optimism at the moment. There's a lot of people in Afghanistan who feel like the opportunity has been missed. Last year was a good opportunity for aid and development to pour all across the country. But I think not all hope is lost. I think the West needs to really pay attention to Afghanistan again. Unfortunately, everyone is focused on Iraq, and Afghanistan really feels the brunt of that.
Hamida, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Reporter Hamida Ghaffour writes for the Los Angeles Times. She joined us from Kabul, Afghanistan.
Just ahead, British businesswomen learn the art of the deal from a voice coach who says American women should also take a deep breath and find their inner business voice.
And later, Southern Baptists quit their World Alliance, complaining about its anti-American thinking.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
In Britain, there's a new trend. Businesswomen flocking to voice coaches to make their voices sound more powerful. It's been reported that even the Iron Lady herself, former Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, had a lesson or two. We asked British actor and voice coach Yvonne Gillen if there are types of American voices that could use some instruction.
Oh, for heaven's sake, I don't know if I can speak exactly like her, but you take the voice up here, and it's really absolutely behind the nose, and it's on the throat.
Kind of thing.
Like
and
that.
The other one, too, of course.
It's the baby voice. And that, of course, goes down very, very well in business, because, of course, it's not threatening.
Not threatening, and, says Yvonne, not a deal closer. So we decided to ask her, what should American women do if they want to command more authority in the workplace?
one of the main things that they really need to do is to breathe.
Breathing's good.
Breathing's good. We take breath in through our mouth, and we have everything to do in the day, and we have to answer telephones, and we have to coordinate something with something else, and so we gasp breath, a kind of panic breath goes on, and we hold on to this breath instead of breathing in through our nose. We've forgotten the nose.
I think most women can identify with that, and they can feel it in their voices. I know I can feel in my voice when I'm tense and I'm not breathing deeply and it starts to go up and up and up and sound choked.
That's right. It goes absolutely up here. They are very high, absolutely on the throat. They should return to their natural voice. You see, I don't think women speak with their natural voices. What happened was that men have this amazingly dramatic and public change of voice from boy to man. Nothing quite as dramatic happens in that way. Woman's voice lowers slightly at about 9. But we take it up into child to, I suppose, kind of compensate, to still be up there, still be noticed, instead of which we should really begin to work on our natural voice, which comes from the gut. We should be speaking our mind from our gut. And that, when you go back to Mrs. Thatcher, she was a typical, very competitive woman who wanted to do extremely well and win over everybody. So, in fact, her voice was up here. It was very shrill. She had one of those voices which, my God, you can hear, because it cuts through everything. And so they took her away. And what they did was they brought her voice down here. So, of course, she spoke from her gut. Now, you may not have loved totally all the things she did, idiosyncratic things, but she had a very, very powerful instrument.
Are you saying that women should try to sound more like men? Are we?
No, not at all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. But I think that they need to. Most women's voices are about half an octave. Their natural voice is half an octave lower than the one they use.
Huh. How does a woman find that? I mean, literally just sit there and try to speak lower.
No, no, absolutely not at all. It really does mean doing some exercises. Beginning, in fact, to play with the voice.
Mm. Yvonne, we have one of our co-workers, Lindsay Crudell, is in the studio with us. She just graduated from Boston University here in Boston. Lindsay's going to speak to you and just say hello and, ask how the weather is perhaps so you can get a sense of her voice. And then we thought just briefly you might tell her what she might do. Lindsay?
Right.
Introduce yourself.
Well, hello, I'm Lindsay. It's a pleasure to speak with you today. I was born in Cranston, Rhode Island, and I attended college at Boston University here, and I'm a producer for the Here and Now program in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
Feeling a bit self-conscious about my voice now.
It's a very sweet and warm voice.
Thank you.
I suppose what you can look for is variety. People tend to play safe, so they keep their voice, on just a very few notes, rather than recognizing that there are many different notes. What's useful is reading poetry. Take a poem, underline the important words, and read it back to yourself. Hmm. Out loud, of course.
You also write, read out loud from a newspaper, hum. Humming, what, gets your throat vibrating?
It's brilliant. Humming is terrific.
Yvonne, do you think that, you just spoke very briefly with Lindsay, who's very bright, but do you think if she was going in to pitch, a $10 million project in a room full of men in suits, she would be listened to?
No, probably not. It's rather too sweet, I think is the word I would use. Now, that's there forever. She can always use that. It's, again, finding other notes, almost other roles within the voice.
My first inclination would be to lower my voice, and I suppose that's not the right...
Is that as low as it goes?
No. The lowest my voice would go would be something like this, probably.
I think the thing is that one wouldn't want you to have a mannerism that was false. It's really finding... At the moment, I can hear you're breathing in through your mouth. Mm-hmm. I would like you to take a breath in through your nose and let it out through your mouth. Through your nose, in through the nose, and out through the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a very different breath from the breath that you take in through your mouth and let out through your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And we begin to access a bit of the jolly old bod, the
The middle part of you, the part where the ribs are open and flexible and the lungs expand, and that's where you speak from.
Yvonne, we're having some fun here making Lindsay breathe for us in the studio, but this is very serious. I know you've heard from clients who have gone to make such a big presentation and had male colleagues in the room say, well, what she's trying to say is... this can be devastating for a career if you cannot speak and represent yourself.
Absolutely.
Do you recommend that women get voice training, by and large, if they're going to be in the business world?
Yes, I do. And it's a good idea to do it in groups. Taking women away and just working with them purely on the relaxation, on the breathing, on having fun and playing different parts and roles together makes one heck of a difference. Mm.
Well, Yvonne Gillen, thank you so much.
Good, thank you.
And Lindsay Crudell, thank you too.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Yvonne Gillen is an actor, writer, and voice coach to British businesswomen.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, the 9/11 Commission gets ready to wrap up its work this week.
And one of the most heralded books of the summer, One Man's Story of His Friendship with a Benedictine Monk, that's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Southern Baptists voted to withdraw from the Baptist World Alliance today during their convention in Indianapolis. Some members complained that the International Alliance was too liberal and anti-American in its thinking. The convention agenda this week also includes whether church members should take their children out of public schools. Nancy Ammerman is a professor of sociology of religion at Boston University and the author of the book Baptist Battles. And Professor, can you tell us what this vote means for the Baptist Alliance and all of the 46 million people who belong to it?
Well, it means, among other things, of course, that the Baptist Alliance will lose one of its founding members and a fairly substantial portion of its budget. That portion will probably be made up by other Baptist bodies and by individual Baptist churches around the world. So the financial hit, while it seems very large immediately, will probably in the long term not be a big problem. It does mean, of course, that the largest of the Baptist bodies in the world has now decided that it wants to go its own way and loses that sense of connection with the larger Baptist universe.
Mm. And the last straw was reportedly the acceptance of a moderate group, the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship, into the Baptist Alliance. Is this as simple as a fight between moderates and conservatives in the church?
Well, it's certainly a product of that. The Cooperative Baptist Fellowship was formed by more moderate Southern Baptist churches about 10 years ago, and much smaller, of course, but still a formidable presence. And basically, the strategy of the Southern Baptists since then has been, if you like the Cooperative Baptists, we don't like you. Mm-hmm. And there's been a kind of continuous separation from other organizations that the Cooperative Baptists have joined.
And there's also a resolution to boycott public schools. Is that likely to pass? And if so, what are they suggesting as the alternative?
Well, I'm sure they're suggesting homeschooling and private Christian schools as the alternative. My hunch is that it will pass. It certainly is in the line with the kind of conservative thinking and conservative support that we've seen in the Southern Baptist Convention now for, well, really for 25 years, but sort of in an uninterrupted fashion for the last 10 years. It certainly indicates, again, the kind of growing sense of separation from the larger culture that this denomination is signaling.
And also, we understand President Bush is going to be addressing the convention later on this afternoon. This is a presidential election year. Are Southern Baptists a solid voting bloc that he can count on? I mean, do they vote, and do they vote as one?
Well, they do vote, but they certainly don't vote as one. Baptists are notoriously independent-minded. Jimmy Carter, who himself used to be a Southern Baptist, used to say that every year the Southern Baptist Convention would pass a bunch of resolutions, and then they'd go home, and in their church, they'd vote just the opposite the next Sunday. So I think Bush can certainly count on the kind of conservative support that he will see when he but they will see from him a kind of synergy of conservatism between the leadership in the denomination and his agenda. But this is not a solid voting bloc.
And just in the few seconds we have left, if Baptists are talking about disengaging from public education, might they not also be inclined to disengage from politics?
That's a constant struggle for conservative Christians who, on the one hand, think that what the best thing they could do for the world is to help more people find salvation and plan for the next world, and on the other hand, think that maybe they ought to work on making this world a more hospitable place.
Well, Nancy, thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. Nancy Ammerman is a professor of sociology of religion at Boston University School of Theology. She joined us from Boston.
Waco. Yes, it's next door to the current president's Texas Crawford Ranch, but the first image conjured up by the word Waco is of a burning barn, an explosive fire that killed 70 people, 21 of them children, all of them members of the Branch Davidian religious cult. The 1993 catastrophe followed a 51-day standoff between the FBI and cult leader David Koresh, who, according to recorded evidence from inside the building, ordered his followers to set the fires that would incinerate them and may have shot 20 of them as well. It was thought that the Branch Davidian sect died that day, along with its charismatic leader. But according to Chicago Tribune reporter Howard Witt, a faithful few gather every Saturday to pray and wait for David Koresh to return and lead them to the Promised Land. Howard Witt is based in Austin, Texas. He joins us on his cell phone. Howard, how many followers are there, and do they meet on that same site?
Yes, there's really just a handful of them. There's about a half a dozen or so, and they do meet at the same site. They meet in a little chapel that was built several years ago right on top of the site where the compound burned down. And they worship every Saturday, and basically they study the teachings and the spoken and written words of David Koresh, and they fully expect him to come back and be resurrected.
As you write, some of these people have joined this dwindling sect since the catastrophe, but some were members even then. One escaped the fire. Why do they tell you they still belong?
You know, it's a fascinating question. These people believed so sincerely and so fully in David Koresh and the fact that he was their Messiah, and they believed his teachings, and they sacrificed so much in terms of losing their family members and themselves being injured in this fire that I think they can't afford to not believe anymore. Because as one man told me who I interviewed, if he lets go of this, if he doesn't believe this anymore, then what could he have left to believe? And how could he believe that everything he's lived his life for was a lie?
The man you spoke to, his daughter died in the fire. Koresh had instituted this idea that he could take as wives the young teenagers in the cult, but no one, everyone else had to remain celibate. So it's mind-boggling. But we read that it's a mecca for tourists as well, including Timothy McVeigh before the Oklahoma City bombing. Who else do you see there?
Well, Timothy McVeigh was probably the most famous tourist there, but it really is a mecca for right-wingers and militia members to visit, because to them this is the classic example of the evil federal government massacring, as they say, all of these innocent folks. And so McVeigh took his inspiration, and as you know, when he bombed the Oklahoma City building a couple years after Waco, he claimed that this was one of his main inspirations for doing that, to get back at the federal government. And many other right-wingers have taken their inspiration as well. So now what you have is periodically, you know, right-wingers will make their pilgrimages to this place. And, in fact, the chapel that was built on the site was donated, the funds and the labor for that was donated by right-wing militia-type folks to have this chapel there as a place for them to gather as well.
Well, Howard, in just the few seconds we have, what is your sense? Is this cult going to die out?
I think absolutely it's dwindling. I mean, you know, it's not like they're attracting new members. I mean, the problem with a cult like this is it depended on the charisma of David Koresh. And, of course, without him there, you've just got some lost souls, I think, who are kind of dwindling and hanging on. But there's no more future for the Branch Davidians. But, of course, our experience in America is that, you know, another cult leader is going to pop up somewhere, and we seem to have these recurrent type of stories.
Well, Howard, thank you for telling us about it.
Sure.
Howard Witt, Texas-based reporter for the Chicago Tribune.
You're listening to Here and Now. Oceanographers have located a fleet of submerged World War II submarines off the coast of Japan, the first time these high-tech Japanese subs have been seen since they were sunk by the U.S. Navy in 1946. The Navy recently declassified documents from that mission, giving a research team the clues it needed to find and study the wreckage. Brett Faniff of Texas A&M University co-led the expedition and joins us now from College Station, Texas. And Brett, tell us, first of all, how did these subs come to be in American hands, and why did the U.S. Navy sink them and hide where they were?
Well, at the end of the war, the subs were turned over to the United States Navy as part of the surrender, along with a lot of other equipment. And we sequestered them in Sasebo Bay, which was a Japanese naval base, which is about 40 miles north of Nagasaki. Our other allies in the war, including Britain and the Soviet Union, would be entitled to some of the spoils, and we really didn't want them to have these submarines because they were a significant technological advancement as compared with Soviet submarines. So we took them out about 60 miles offshore and disposed of these 24 submarines and hopefully kept them out of the hands of the Soviet Navy.
What part of their technology was so advanced?
They were just well-machined all the way around, and certainly better than what the Soviets could field. In the case of the I-402, which is one of the subs we were after, it was the largest submarine of World War II. In fact, today is still one of the largest submarines ever built, and it was actually carrying aircraft. It was more or less an underwater aircraft carrier designed to attack the United States directly.
How would that work on a submarine?
They actually built a separate pressure hull that was attached to the top of the submarine and adjacent to the conning tower, and it was over 120 feet long, and it had a big locking pressure-type door. So all the planes were sort of assembled sitting up on a set of tracks inside this big pressure hull. When you wanted to launch the submarine, an aircraft, you'd surface the sub, open the door, push the aircraft out, or they'd be hydraulically pulled out. The wings would fold out just like on an aircraft carrier, and then there was a huge catapult on the front deck of the submarine that would just catapult launch them, much like an aircraft carrier. They didn't get a chance to use them, but it would have changed certainly the way we prosecuted the war in the Pacific had they actually been able to directly bomb the United States, which is what the intent was.
And did the Navy know that they had that capability?
We didn't at the time. We found out later on, right at the end of the war.
These were hidden for a number of years. I wonder if you can describe the eureka moment for us when you were looking around underwater and there they were, something that nobody had seen since World War II.
You know, you creep up on it with this robotic vehicle and it's dark at about 700 feet deep, and just looming out of the darkness you see this big shape that sort of curves up and away from you, and it's the hull of this absolutely massive Japanese submarine, and it's just unbelievably exciting to sweep along it, to find the bow, and then to just come up and fly over the conning tower. And really, it's a submarine that looks like it's settled into the bottom but still sailing along. It's encrusted completely with colorful corals and anemones. It just looks fantastic.
Mm. Well, now that we know where they are, what happens next?
We want to go back and look at all 24 of them. What these submarines represent is the largest collection of World War II submarines. And it's the only collection of Japanese World War II submarines. And it's literally one of almost every type of Japanese submarine produced during the war. So it's virtually an underwater museum. We'd like to catalog that for posterity and do some assessment on the corrosion to see how long these things are going to be around and use that as information for studying other World War II sites as well.
Brett Faniff is a doctoral student in oceanography at Texas A&M University in College Station, Texas.
You're listening to Here and
Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The psychedelic jam band Phish releases its last studio album today. It's called Undermined. Little solace to the scores of loyal Phish fans still reeling from news that after 20 years, the foursome is breaking up.
Undecided, undefined, undisturbed, yet undermined. Relocated, not retired, reprimanded and rewired.
Phish started playing together in the 80s at the University of Vermont and built a dedicated following, playing songs like Free at their freewheeling live shows. Phish also has a very active website, a newsletter, they cover other bands' hits, and they have a liberal policy allowing fans to tape and trade their performances. The Phish farewell concert will be in Vermont this August, but many fans can't bear to say goodbye.
What I found compelling about them was their ability to improvise, you know, really well as a group to create one sound in a live environment.
I like Phish because they got nice grooves and they just sound tight, and I just like that style of jam music. It's just tight.
Yeah, they got a real mellow, flowing sound. And it is a nice jam band. They've been around for a while doing their thing, so it sucks they broke up, though.
Just standing up front at one of their shows, there's something godly about them as they rock.
I never meant to cause you any problem. Never meant to cause you any pain.
They'll still be playing 10 years from now, I think.
So you don't think this is it for Phish?
I don't know. They say this every year, don't they? But I'm still going to be there in Vermont just in case, you know.
Only want to see you laughing in the purple rain. Purple rain, purple rain.
Phish's cover of Prince's Purple Rain as Phish fans reflect on the big breakup. But wait, there's always the new CD. And here now, pop and rock critic Tim Riley has a review of Undermined. Hello, Tim.
Hey, how are you doing, Robin?
I'm fine, but I should note first, many people I know are not. They're still in mourning.
People very upset about this, and they need to remember that 20 years together as a band is a major accomplishment.
Because
I mean, most relationships don't last 20 years. Think of about a four-way relationship. People don't understand how difficult it is to keep four egos afloat, you know, when fame hits.
You've written of the Beatles extensively. They had how many years?
The Beatles had 7 years recording.
Okay,
right? They had a 7-year career. So a 20-year performing career is an amazing accomplishment. So they really need to remember that and reflect on that. And I think that that's kind of what Phish is after, is to just say, look, we want to end on a happy note. We don't want to end on a sour note.
Is it a good note? It's a new album. What does it sound like?
Well, it's a very radio-friendly album. It's very up. It's peppy. It's poppy. You can almost hear DJs salivating at these hook-happy refrains they built into this new record.
When I see the connection, though I see, I don't stare. Though I see, I don't stare. When I'm lost in my reflection, though I see, I don't stare. Though I see, I don't stare.
That's from Phish's farewell CD. It's called The Connection. But what are you saying? Do you think that Phish has sold out because it's more commercial and maybe more poppy?
No, I think they've always had a really poppy sound, and they've always had a wide appeal, which has attracted a lot of listeners. So I don't think they've sold out. I think they've always had a strong affection for hooks, and they understand what makes a really good pop song work. But I think that they're, you know, Phish is a difficult band for a critic to embrace, because while they have a lot of strengths, the weaknesses really are pretty significant. On the one hand, they're accomplished musicians. You have to respect these guys are really terrific guitar players, bass player, drum player, and they've built a terrific ensemble, and, you know, their concert following speaks to that. On the other hand, you know, their templates, their heroes are Frank Zappa and the Grateful Dead And, you know, Zappa and the Dead are much more remembered for their sort of persona than they are the material. And the other thing is that nobody in Phish is really a great singer. Nobody's going to stand up and say, well, here's the great singer that Phish produced. You know, the Dead did not have a great singer. Phish makes up for that by singing a lot of harmonies, which is an excellent solution to that if you don't have a really good lead singer. In fact, on this new album, the final track is called Grind, and it's a barbershop quartet.
I can bend in 68 ways. I have lived for 12,000 days. 28 teeth inside of my head. Grind three types of things and I'm sad that they're dead. Grind, 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 grind.
That's a song called Grind. It's the last track on this new album from Phish called Undermined. When they got the idea of this barbershop quartet, they decided they would hire this renowned barbershop quartet arranger named Joe Lillies. The problem is, you know, it's harmless fun and it's a nice little track, but is it going to do anything more than be a novelty track? Is it going to wear well over time? And I really have my question whether that's going to wear well over time.
But as you know, in the short term, there are people who, and I can name them, who adore this band, and they will follow them to the ends of the earth and to airport runways, and they'll be naked for them. And so what is it about the music that is compelling?
Well, I think that there's an essential element of fun to a Phish show, and the humor has always been the saving grace of this band. You know, a Phish show is always going to be different. You never know what you're going to get. There's always going to be surprises. When I saw them back in 1988 or 89, they did Joe Walsh's Walk Away, and the guitarist and the bassist jumped up and down throughout the whole song. In fact, they jumped up and down on trampolines. So it's this really hilarious idea, and they're really into that idea of let's do something kooky and hilarious. And of course, that creates a wonderful bond with your audience. And you always are going to have some fun at a Phish concert. That's a key element.
And they picked up where the Grateful Dead left off in a sort of being the anti-establishment band. They have this tremendous relationship with their fans. They have newsletters. They allow them to download music. They've always sort of carved out that space.
Right. And the fans can tape their shows. And there's a big online tape trading thing that goes on. Also, I mean, the other thing you can't really deny for people who love to just go and hear really good guitar playing, Trey Anastasia's really wonderful guitar player. And there's plenty of that on this new record, too, if you listen to this next track, A Song I Heard the Ocean Sing. And Trey Anastasia really lets it rip on his guitar.
I Heard the Ocean Sing from the Phish CD, Undermined. Tim, what do you think about the CD, which they wrote, by the way, before they decided to break up?
They wrote and recorded it before they broke up, so it's not a self-conscious farewell, which I think it would have been a tad heavy-handed. But, I mean, you got to say, here's four people who've kept an audience that's done nothing but grow for over 20 years, and they're trying to bow out gracefully. They're trying to say, we don't want to fall into the trap and you know, take it for granted and run out on stage and start to do the same thing over and over again every night. So you have to respect them from that. But I have to say, one of my favorite bumper stickers of the 90s says it all for me. And if you're doing a piece on Phish, you want to get this in. And the quote from the bumper sticker is, Jerry's dead, Phish sucks, get a job.
All right, then. Phish fans, send all your emails to Tim. And the point is, move on. Move on.
Yeah, you know, there's a whole jam band phenomenon. I mean, there's plenty of other bands to choose from. And Phish will reunite. I mean, I guarantee you they will reunite and they will have special events where people can come together again and hear Phish concerts again.
And there's always the ice cream.
There's always the ice cream.
Always the ice cream. Ben and Jerry's Phish Food. Tim, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Tim Riley here now as pop and rock critic on the new and final Phish CD, Undermined. For more on the CD and the Phish Tour, go to our website, here-now.org. And this note, Tim's new book is called Fever, How Rock and Roll Transformed Gender in America.
Nothing's ensconced, nothing's entrenched, nothing's entangled or twisted or wrenched. Everything smoothly flows right through my head. What I had hoped might linger is swept off instead. Tunnels and channels and chasms.
shiny smooth streams and unclimbable cliffs. I see you there ever so slowly being drawn to the sea. As if by some signal that's unheard by me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Your hand is extended, but then you resent. And you like my thoughts, all borne off by the wind. Nothing's in scars.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.